step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Autumn's Oddities. I'm Autumn. The weather, let's talk about the weather like right up top. It's been glorious here lately, and it's definitely helping the old seasonal depression. I don't know if you've seen this meme, but it's like, nobody thinks seasonal depression is real until you get like a 70-something degree in February and it feels like you popped a Molly. That is exactly how it feels. It doesn't really bother me personally to stay inside all day. I love being on a couch. Truly, I do. But my daughter wants to be outside like as much as possible. So the freezing weather kind of puts a damper on that. That's why the last few days have been pretty nice. I have no good segue. So speaking of nice weather, Miami has that. That was terrible. I apologize deeply. I just did not have another segue. I did not have the energy to come up with another one. Today's case does take us to Miami Beach, along with several other cities. And I wish that the fictional and fantastic anti-hero Dexter was real in these kinds of cases, because I think that he could have very easily tracked down this murdering little monster. I'm talking about Andrew Cunanan, who would win the crown at the world's biggest liar pageant and the murder of Gianni Versace and at least four other people that we know of. In 1997, Gianni Versace was the Elvis of the fashion world. And I don't mean that literally, and I don't mean that he was a musician. I mean that he brought his own spin to his designs. They were bright, they were over the top, they were campy, they were mixed with high art and sex appeal. His models became supermodels, his fashion became art, and his empire expanded across the globe. It seemed like nothing could stop the fashion monolith. After weeks of working 16-hour days, Versace and his partner, Antonio D'Amico, went to their vacation home in Miami Beach to take a break, because he needed it. But even on vacation, Versace was up with the sun. The notorious workaholic would constantly sketch designs and send them back to Milan to his sister Donatella, maybe you've heard of her, who was preparing for Milan Fashion Week, which was just 2 months away. Versace loved to go on walks, especially on or near the beach, and his mansion was and still is located on prime real estate. It's oceanfront. It's on Ocean Drive. And his partner was thrilled to finally have a holiday together. So Gianni met model and actor Antonio D'Amico at La Scala Theater in Milan, and the two struck up a friendship. Slowly, over the years, their friendship grew into a relationship that lasted for 15 years, literally until the day that Versace died. Antonio says that his long-term partner paid very close attention to the needs of those he cared about. He was always ready to help his friends in any way that he could. Versace had only just come out in 1995 as gay and announced that he had been in a serious relationship with Antonio and described it as a deep and enduring love. At the time, it was very important to have such a famous public figure come out because, of course, being gay or different was frowned upon then. It was very controversial. And sadly, there are still a lot of people who have hate in their hearts for those who are different from them or who challenge their own beliefs. Either way, Versace became an icon for the gay community. Antonio said that although Versace was one of the most important fashion designers that there was, he was also the sweetest man in the world. Gianni Versace was born on December 2nd, 1945, to humble beginnings in southern Italy. Early on, he worked at his mother's dress shop, where she employed up to 12 seamstresses. Mom was a badass. He was a quick study and soon began designing and making his own clothes. Gianni was heavily influenced by the Greek architecture and history that was prevalent in his hometown, and he was also very heavily influenced by Andy Warhol's work. And I mean, I feel like you can see it in there. In 1973, he became the designer of Biblos, a successful Jenny's youthful line. And Jenny's is a department store. We don't have them in the United States. They're in Italy. I don't know if they're elsewhere, but they were in Italy at the time. And in 1977, he designed Complice, another more experimental line for Jenny's. A few years later, encouraged by his success, Versace presented his first signature collection for women at the Palazzo della Permanente Art Museum of Milan. And I know my Italian accent is not good. I have never, ever even attempted to speak Italian. His first fashion show followed in September of the same year. His first boutique was opened in Milan's Via della Spiga in 1978. And by that time, he had launched his first independent line with his sister Donatella and his brother Santo, and they very quickly became a staple of the fashion mecca Milan. Gianni loved working with his family, and he believed that the strength of their design house was the fact that they were a literal blood family. By the 1990s, the family business had become a billion-dollar brand, and it was about to go public. They were about to make a lot of money. Versace had become a household name at that point after dressing the likes of, oh, I don't know, maybe you've heard of them, Princess Diana, Elton John, and the iconic Elizabeth Hurley gown, you know, the black one with all the cutouts and all the big giant like gold pins and Versace Medusa head buttons. It's iconic. As his fame grew, it became more difficult for Gianni to escape the spotlight, and that's when he discovered what he called the sanctuary of Miami Beach. He and Antonio were on a long layover in Miami on their way to Cuba a few years before they did buy their mansion, so they decided to go exploring. The two decided to have a walkabout in the city, and they were blown away by the color, the people, the culture, the music, the food, just a melting pot. And in 1992, Gianni bought a dilapidated villa in the heart of Miami Beach on Ocean Drive and transformed it into a lavish private retreat from the world, Casa Casarina. Everybody refers to his home as the Versace Mansion, of course, because of its, you know, infamy, but the actual name of the home was Casa Casarina. Versace filled his mansion with art and color, which attracted the attention of socialites and celebrities alike. And apparently Miami at the time wasn't considered like the high point of art or fashion, but with its newest resident stirring things up, the city was reborn as a vibrant vacation spot for the rich and the beautiful. It became the new epicenter of fashion nightlife for the cool kids. Versace described Miami as a place. Listen to me have a tiny little mental breakdown. He described Miami as a place where you can be yourself. Although he was very wealthy and very famous, he liked to walk through the streets of Miami with no bodyguard, kind of like it was his hometown. Antonio told him that he should get some bodyguards, but Gianni refused. And I don't think he realized at the time that he wasn't really walking around unnoticed. He was kind of living in a fishbowl, and most eyes were on him. He did not realize that he had a target on his back. On July 15th, 1997, Antonio awoke around 7 a.m. He got dressed. He went downstairs for breakfast with their friend Lazaro. Antonio asked the mansion staff where Mr. Versace was, as he was supposed to eat with them, and they said that he had gone out to buy a newspaper and some magazines so that he could keep up with the latest fashions. And just as Versace reached up to put the key in his gate, shots rang out. Antonio heard two shots, and he immediately said he had a terrible sense of dread. He ran outside to find his partner, Gianni, sprawled out on the stairs just in front of his gate, surrounded by blood. In shock, Antonio noticed a man just kind of standing up the sidewalk. It looked odd, and he was just looking at them, and this man bleeding to death on the ground. You know, a normal person sees a situation like that and doesn't just stand there and stare at you. The man was wearing a hat and gym clothes and just kind of standing there smirking at the two men who were trying desperately to save Versace. Antonio said that he just knew that this was the person who had shot Gianni, and he screamed at Lazaro, "He did it! Go get him!" And the man took off on foot and Lazaro gave chase. But as Lazaro started gaining on the man in the alley, he turned around and pointed a gun in Lazaro's direction. And of course, the only thing he could have done was stop chasing the man, and he ran in another direction to find the police. Miami Police retired division chief George Navarro had taken the day off, and he was golfing with the assistant police chief when he got a call. I feel like that's always how it goes. These detectives are like, it was my day off. I was 3 days away from retirement, blah, blah, blah. But it was from one of his lead detectives who informed him that there was a shooting on Ocean Drive and that he needed to come in because it was Gianni Versace. He had been shot twice in the head at point blank range just outside of his home in broad daylight. And the audacity of the crime was shocking to police because Versace was walking on one of the busiest streets in the city in broad daylight, standing right in front of his own house. And he also, of course, just happened to be one of the most famous people in the world. The news of Gianni Versace's shooting spread quickly, and the mansion became a circus. Media outlets from all parts of the world came to report on the shooting of an icon. And I don't like this at all. I was listening to some of the old news clips, you know, reporting this, and a lot of the media outlets actually blamed Versace for his own death because how dare this man go down the street to buy a newspaper? How dare he? Like, what did he expect? He was asking for it. Like, he felt comfortable in his neighborhood and he walked around alone sometimes. That's victim blaming and it's gross. He went down the street to get a paper. It doesn't matter what he was doing. Does not deserve to be gunned down. Investigators found several witnesses who saw the shooter run into a nearby garage. So additional patrol units were called in, and immediately they formed a perimeter around the parking garage at 13th Street. But unfortunately, that particular garage had a lot of exits. Patrol units entered the garage and began a floor-by-floor search, and when they got to the third level, they saw a red pickup truck with a pile of clothing laying on the ground next to it. And that's called conspicuous. You want to be inconspicuous when you've just committed a murder and are trying to get away with it. The clothing was damp with sweat, and they believed that this truck was tied to the shooter somehow. They continued to search the garage, but it was too late. The shooter had escaped. Another witness came forward. They said they saw someone who fit the description of the shooter getting into a yellow cab just in front of the garage. Back at the mansion, first responders worked desperately to save Versace's life. Antonio, he did not have a good feeling about it. He had seen the massive amount of blood that Versace had lost, and he knew that there probably wasn't any chance that his partner was going to survive. He knew that he was gone. 50-year-old Gianni Versace was pronounced dead at 9:21 a.m. With little known about the details, mourners poured into the streets in front of Casu Casarina. People were angry. They were heartbroken because this was just, it was a completely senseless killing. The police eventually had to block off the street in front of the mansion because there were just so many mourners, so many people putting flowers, pictures, you know, just trinkets in front of the mansion, and those mourners wanted answers. With Versace's death, I believe he was Detective Navarro, knew that he had a high visibility homicide on his hands. Yes, he did indeed. The first thing Navarro did was attempt to find out who the suspects might be, because that is the most obvious place to start. The motive that seemed like the most likely at the time was robbery, because Versace had over $1,100 in cash on his person when he was killed, and a gold medallion and 6 credit cards. But they ruled out robbery pretty quickly because all of that was still on his person at the time he was killed and at the time first responders got there. And also, if somebody was looking to rob him, why would they shoot him in front of the gate of his house and not go in? Obviously, they know who he is, they know he's extremely wealthy and that his house is probably full of valuables. So why wouldn't they have gone inside? He had put the key in the gate and everything. If it was going to, if the motive of this murder was robbery, they would have gone in and taken things. At the very least, they would have taken all the things that he had on him. Then investigators began to consider more personal motives like jealousy, love, and obsession. Versace was shot execution style in the head by a .40 caliber weapon. And here's something extra weird. A mourning dove was laid next to his body, also dead. And a dead bird, if you aren't aware, is actually a classic mafia hit calling card. So why was that bird placed next to Gianni Versace's body? And the only explanation that investigators had was that this was a targeted execution. In their search for clues, Miami police veered off into a strange direction. Navarro ordered an autopsy on the bird, which is smart. But the medical examiner had never, up to that point, performed an autopsy on a bird. Even so, they were able to retrieve a partial projectile of the same bullet that hit Versace. And I don't mean like came from the same caliber weapon. It was the same bullet. It turns out that the bullet that hit Versace, one of them ricocheted and then hit the bird as it was flying by in what turned out to be an incredibly bizarre coincidence. And so with that information, the mob hit was ruled out and investigators were back to square one. They had a crime scene, they had a vehicle of interest, and they had a parking garage to go off of, but that was about it. The red truck, police discovered, actually had stolen South Carolina license plate on it, but what they found inside was what really shocked them and threw them through a loop and, had them realizing this was a lot bigger than what they had initially thought. The truck was full of personal items, almost as if someone had been living in it. Even though there was an abundance of evidence in the truck, none of it seemed connected to the next piece that they would find. They just kept finding things that were from different locations, different places. Like it was strange. None of it made sense. It was essentially a truck that looked like it was filled with items owned by several different people from different parts of the country. Confusing, right? During the parking garage search, Navarro was pulled away by urgent news. At approximately 12:30 p.m., one of his detectives told him that there was an FBI agent waiting outside to speak with him. The agent told Navarro that he had been chasing down the suspect for more than 2 months. The suspect in the murder of Gianni Versace was also a suspect in 4 other murders and was being searched for all over the country. Navarro still didn't know how the suspect was connected to the Versace murder, and then the FBI agent told him that the suspect had stolen the red pickup truck. Boom, there's your connection. Navarro then asked the agent what kind of weapon had been used in the previous 4 murders, and wouldn't you know it, it was a .40 caliber gun. Navarro wanted to confirm that the truck in the garage was, in fact, the same one that the FBI was looking for, and conveniently, the agent had the VIN. And I don't say VIN number because VIN, V-I-N, stands for Vehicle Identification Number. So if you say VIN number, you're saying Vehicle Identification Number number. I'm going to say VIN for the purposes of this podcast. The agent read the VIN out over the radio, and they were an exact match for the abandoned truck in the Miami parking garage. So that was it. As it turned out, the suspect in the murder of Gianni Versace was a serial or spree killer at the top of the FBI's most wanted list, Andrew Cunanan. The Miami police and FBI began working together to find this extremely dangerous man. Obviously, Miami police wanted to know every bit of information that the FBI had on Cunanan, and they decided to build a profile on him, you know, to get a better idea of where to look for him. FBI profilers create suspect profiles by looking at a person's past behaviors as a predictor of their future behaviors. Consistent. So who was Andrew Cunanan? I may be saying his name wrong. I don't care. I don't care about mispronouncing the names of murderers. Again, and also, I'm not going to ruin the ending for you, but he's not around to care. He was the youngest of four children, born in a San Diego suburb to Modesto and Marianne Cunanan. His parents had a pretty contentious relationship, and his mother was Italian-American and his father was Filipino. But both the parents did agree on one thing, that they were going to live vicariously through their favorite son, Andrew. Andrew's parents had aspirations of great success, but they didn't really live up to what they believed was their full potential. So his parents treated him like the golden child and lavished him with love and attention. Andrew was apparently very smart, and he had read the entire Bible by the time he was 7 years old, and also a set of encyclopedias by the age of 14. It's reported that his IQ was about 150, and he had what was described as a beautiful mind. I didn't describe him that way, just so you know. While Andrew's siblings went to public school, his parents sent him to a fancy private high school. That's not cute. Like, what the hell? You're like, your other kids, you're like, ah, fuck them. And you send one of them to private school. That's cool. I wouldn't be bitter about that or anything. Andrew was openly gay in high school, which was definitely not the norm at the time, but he was still really popular. He was flamboyant and he liked to cause a stir. He was messy. He even showed up to his senior prom in a red patent leather suit with an older gentleman as his date. He was just like out there fully and was voted most likely to be remembered by his senior class, and they just did not know how spot on they were. Rather than attending college, Andrew started college, but he dropped out. He became a fixture in the San Diego gay scene. He never had a job. He just kind of, you know, sugar babied his way through life by getting money from wealthy older men. He also had a large circle of friends who he would lavish with money that he had been given by his older benefactors. He would buy drinks, dinner, VIP tables, and his friends soon began to wonder, like, how is he able to pay for all of this? This is a lot of money. Well, he was not affording anything. He was actually charging the credit cards and the bank accounts of his sugar daddies without their knowledge. Andrew wanted to be rich. He loved the lifestyle, but he did not actually want to work to earn any of that wealth. He was entitled. He was an entitled little bitch. He thought he was owed all of this. And like, how do you think you're owed all of this when you had a silver spoon up your ass for most of your life, kid? Like, you're not owed anything. It was not enough for Andrew to be popular and, you know, seemingly rich, though. He wanted to be someone important. Mainly, he wanted to be famous. He had a very charismatic personality, as most narcissists do, which initially drew people in. But once they got to know him, most people realized that Andrew lied, like, a lot. He was notorious for spinning elaborate lies about his own wealth, connection, and status. And one of his friends, I actually read a quote from one of his friends that said that Andrew like told this big story about meeting a famous person and like recently meeting this famous person and hanging out with him. And his friend was like, I didn't have the heart to tell him that the person he was talking about had already been dead for 2 years at that point. So he was legitimately just lying about hanging out with a celebrity who had been dead for 2 years. I mean, I don't know. I probably would have called the guy out, but I do see how it's like, you know, you're just so embarrassed for that person and you know they're lying and you're like, I don't really need to humiliate them. They're doing it themselves. Andrew made up a lot of different origin stories for himself as well. He said he was everything from a trust fund kid to an architect to a designer, an actor, and so on and so on. But he did win the crown at World's Biggest Liar pageant. So, you know, he could have added that accolade to his resume, but he chose not to. He took on whatever personality he needed to have in order to get what he wanted. He just had to look like the most important person in the room, no matter what, and his lies just got bigger and more elaborate. And like I said, he claimed to know a lot of celebrities, and one of whom was Gianni Versace, which has never actually been confirmed with any certainty that they met. I'll get into, there's like some alleged eyewitness testimony about seeing the two of them together that I'll get into later. By 1997, Cunanan's act began to wear on people, like they'd had enough of it. He and his like most recent sugar daddy broke up, and Andrew started living off of his own credit cards without having an income to pay them off. Gather round, children. I think all of you know this. I doubt any of my listeners are people like this psychopath, but if you charge, like, credit cards aren't free money. You got to pay it back eventually, or the credit card company will come after you. You will have bad credit, blah, blah, blah. Money is pretend. Let's all agree on that and just, like, do our own thing. Let's reinstitute the barter system. Who's with me? Probably just a few of us. Anyway, he was no longer able to keep up with the facade of being a wealthy man about town. And it was during that time that Andrew had a falling out with one of his closest friends, Jeffrey Trail, who was a Navy veteran who had moved to Minneapolis. Jeffrey was an Annapolis graduate who served in the Gulf War, and he was known as kind and very brave. But as far as anyone could tell, he had never had a romantic relationship with Cunanan. Interestingly, a few years before the killing spree, Trail had spoken off the record to 48 Hours for a segment about gay people serving in the military during the, you know, very tacky don't ask, don't tell era. Correspondent Richard Schlesinger said that he was an impressive man, he was smart, good looking, and very brave, and that he chose to speak with them because he thought that it was the right thing to do. He did the interview in silhouette, but it was still a tremendous risk, you know, to his career. He had nothing to gain by doing the interview, yet he did take that risk and he spoke out. And everyone at 48 Hours was very impressed with him. So Trail and Cunanan became friends while they were both living in California. They would sometimes go target shooting together, and Cunanan referred to Trail as brother. The veteran, who was politically conservative, rarely drank, and he was also opposed to drugs, though he told other friends that Cunanan was selling illegal substances. That's...
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
That's hearsay. Trail trained with the California Highway Patrol, but he left, eventually taking a job as district manager for a propane retailer in suburban Minneapolis, where he would later meet his unexpected fate at the hands of someone who had been his close friend. Cunanan had broken up with his latest older benefactor, with whom he had been living in La Jolla, but also had another love interest in Minneapolis, one David Madsen, who was an architect that he had met in San Francisco in December of 1995. Cunanan sent Madsen a drink at the bar and soon began a long-distance relationship, where they experimented with S&M, and that was a topic that really interested Cunanan. But the romance began to fizzle out, at least on Madsen's end, probably just tired of the lies and the bullshit. And Cunanan, for his part, was involved with his sugar daddy for much of the same time period, and Madsen just didn't want to deal with his messiness because he is sloppy. At the urging of friends, Madsen began to distance himself from Cunanan. He had become uneasy because Andrew would often disappear or become unreachable, and also the lying. And presumably the reason for that secrecy was that Cunanan was still living in La Jolla with his older boyfriend. So Andrew, Clearly feeling out of control and realizing that his relationships were falling apart, he bought a plane ticket to Minneapolis and he told Madsen that he was going to visit for the weekend. Trail and Madsen, as it turns out, knew each other and they struck up a friendship when they both ended up in Minneapolis, and Cunanan was their mutual friend. And Trail made it clear that he was not going to be around much the weekend of Andrew's visit because his boyfriend, John Hackett, who was a student at the University of Minnesota, was celebrating his 21st birthday, and they were going to have like a big Saturday night on the town. Trail was known to have warned Madsen, who had befriended him casually when they moved to Minneapolis, like they weren't dating or anything. He had warned Madsen that Cunanan was a gigantic freaking liar and that he should stay away from him. But Cunanan arrived in Minneapolis on Friday, April 25th, 1997, and Madsen picked him up from the airport. They had dinner with some friends, and Cunanan presumably spent the night at Madsen's apartment, and the next night he ended up staying at Jeffrey Trail's, and I'm not sure how that happened because Trail didn't seem to like him at all. On Sunday, Trail told his boyfriend that he needed to talk to Cunanan about something pretty important and said he'd meet him at a coffee shop before going out with Hackett later that night between like 10 and 10:30. But Jeffrey never showed up and Hackett began to panic. The panic deepened when Trail didn't return to his apartment on Monday morning, then failed to show up at work. And at that point, his boyfriend went ahead and called the police. When David Madsen also didn't show up to work for 2 days, his colleagues began to worry. They called his apartment, but they got the answering machine. They went to the door, they knocked on it, but he did not answer, so they called the police to do a wellness check. When police got into the apartment, they immediately smelled the odor of death. And inside, they found a decomposing human body rolled up in a rug and a very gruesome crime scene. There was blood everywhere, floor to ceiling, and the body had been rolled into a rug. Investigators assumed that they had found the apartment's tenant, David Madsen, inside of that rug, but instead, they had found the bludgeoned body of Jeffrey Trail. They were able to very quickly realize that it was Jeffrey Trail based on some tattoos. Jeffrey had been struck more than 20 times in the head and upper body with a hammer. The brutality of the killing indicated to investigators that this was a personal killing and suspected missing David Madsen of foul play. Why wouldn't they suspect him? There's a dead body in his apartment and he is nowhere to be found. But as they interviewed Madsen's friends and neighbors, a new narrative emerged. Madsen and Trail, like, they barely knew each other. They were just, you know, kind of casual acquaintances, but their mutual friend, Andrew Cunanan, had been visiting them over the previous weekend. And David had told some of his friends that he was nervous about the visit and that Andrew made him uncomfortable. After that weekend, Jeffrey was dead and both David and Andrew were missing along with Madsen's red Jeep. I don't know why I couldn't spit that out. Sorry. 4 days later, David Madsen's body was found in an isolated park roughly 50 miles from his apartment. He had been shot twice execution style in the head and once in the back. The empty shell casings left at the scene matched a .40 caliber handgun that was missing from Jeffrey Trail's apartment. Investigators assumed that after dumping Madsen's body, Cunanan fled in his Jeep. The hunt was on for a now multiple murderer. The next day, the very next day, there was a report out of Chicago of a homicide involving a very well-known person. Marilyn Miglin came home from a trip to find her husband of 35 years, Lee Miglin, murdered in their garage, and it was another absolutely vicious crime scene. Lee had been stabbed through the heart with a screwdriver, and his body and face were wrapped with tape, paper, and plastic. And it also appeared that the murderer had either slit the throat of Lee Miglin or had attempted to decapitate him with some sort of an electric saw. 72-year-old Lee Miglin was a well-known and well-to-do real estate developer in Chicago who epitomized the American dream, according to his business partner. His wife, Marilyn, was also a successful business owner in her own right. She started a line of cosmetics and perfumes. They had two adult children, Marlena and Duke, who was at the time an aspiring actor in California. Miglin, who owned a real estate company with partner J. Paul Beetler, was home alone in the family's Gold Coast residence when Cunanan arrived in Chicago after his two murders in Minnesota. When David Madsen's Jeep was found parked around the corner from Miglin's home, the hunt was on for a vicious and unpredictable murderer. See, investigators might not be able to connect or may not have been able to connect Cunanan to these murders if he didn't keep, he just keeps ditching the evidence. I don't know if it's arrogance that's causing him to do it. Like, he's just leaving the car that he stole from a previous crime scene. Maybe the Minneapolis murders, he's like, oh, there's no way anybody's going to connect me to this. They won't find David Madsen. They'll just find his Jeep and they'll think that he committed the murders. I don't know. This is a really half-baked scheme. Inside Miglin's house, investigators found that the suspect had taken thousands of dollars in cash, a rare coin collection, and some designer clothes, but they had also left behind some very strange clues. The suspect had eaten a sandwich, had shaved, and had drank a Coke, which seemed like very brazen acts for someone who had just violently murdered another human being. Very brazen. The question then was, did this person kill randomly, specifically Andrew Cunanan? Did he kill randomly, or did he know his third victim? What led him to Miglin's house, however, remained a mystery, and rumors had circulated that Cunanan, you know, in his typical name-dropping manner, had mentioned in passing that he was going to start a business with Miglin's son, Duke. I don't know if any of this is true, but the shocked and horrified family insisted that none of them had ever met the killer and had nothing to do with him whatsoever. Like, Duke, Miglin's son, said, no, I don't know him. Like, if he said he knows me, he's lying. The Chicago police also ruled out that there was any connection. The Miglin family insisted that Lee had absolutely no connection to Andrew Cunanan, and their statement has never been disproved. So police put out an APB on Miglin's dark green 1994 Lexus, which had also been stolen. Cunanan had disappeared, this time with tons of cash and a new car. After killing Lee Miglin on May 3rd, Cunanan's trail went cold, but not for very long. It was just 2 days when there was a break. As it turned out, there was a phone in Miglin's car, which, believe me, was some cutting-edge technology back then. It worked by using a box in the trunk, like a receiver box, that had an antenna, and police were able to determine that the cell phone was being used in Pennsylvania. The FBI was tracking the signal across cell phone towers, and unfortunately, that fact was leaked to the press, and Andrew Cunanan must have heard it. Realizing that he had a tracking device in the trunk of the stolen car, Andrew ditched it. Just 5 days after Lee Miglin's murder, Cunanan struck again. On May 9th, 1997, he went off the beaten path somewhere in New Jersey, and he found a cemetery. The caretaker, William Reese, didn't come home for dinner that evening, and his wife went to check on him. She discovered her husband shot dead in the basement of the cemetery office. Cunanan had taken William to the basement and shot him execution style in the head. And this was very clearly a murder just to gain access to William's truck, which he stole, and he abandoned Lee Miglin's Lexus. William Reese was a married father of a toddler who worked as a cemetery caretaker in Pennsville, New Jersey. The 45-year-old cared for the grounds at Fenn's Point National Cemetery, and he took pride in his work, and he was also known for his generosity. And his wife said about him, "The only thing I can say is that Bill was a Christian, and we take comfort in knowing that he is in heaven. But he leaves behind a lot of people. We loved him." His son Troy, who is now in his 30s, said that everybody loved his dad and that his mom loved him and that, you know, he loved him so much that his dad loved animals. And anytime that his son sees turtles on the road now, just like his dad, he stops and lets them cross the road. And if, you know, his dad saw something like an injured animal on the road, maybe a goose, he would always get out and bandage their little leg up and help out animals in any way possible. He said that his father would always stop on the road just to help perfect strangers with car problems. And it sounds like a very, very nice man and just an absolutely just unnecessary and ridiculous murder. Without the cell phone box in Miglin's Lexus, the FBI no longer had a way to track a man who killed four people in less than 2 weeks. And again, that number could be higher. Like maybe he didn't leave any very obvious evidence behind. Maybe he killed other people. He became the focus of a nationwide manhunt. An FBI director at the time, Janet Reno, pleaded with Americans to contact local law enforcement if they had any clues as to Cunanan's whereabouts. For 2 months, there was no sign of him. That is, until July 15th, when police found the cemetery caretaker's truck in the Miami parking garage. In the hours after Gianni Versace's murder, Miami police and FBI agents scoured the island because they did not believe that Cunanan had gone far. Miami Beach is a barrier island, and police were actually able to shut down access and exits pretty much everywhere in the city. Like, they did it very effectively. They were canvassing the city nonstop, and everything was on lockdown with checkpoints at nearly every intersection. People walked in groups and were very afraid that gay men specifically were being targeted. Andrew Cunanan's face was plastered all over the news and on practically every window and telephone pole in Miami Beach. And that is when all hell broke loose. Investigators went from getting like 10 to 20 tips an hour to getting thousands. It became clear to investigators that Cunanan had been in Miami for quite some time, and witnesses reported previous sightings all over South Beach, one specifically at a diner directly across the street from the police station. It seemed like Cunanan was playing a dangerous game of cat and mouse. But he was not going to be easy to find because, as we know, he had already been living the life of a chameleon, changing his appearance and personality to fit whatever character he was playing. He employed the use of disguises, with witnesses seeing him in wigs, glasses, hats, facial hair, sometimes clean shaven, and even presenting as a woman. But there had been no concrete sightings of Cunanan since Versace's murder. And then finally, a solid lead came in, and it was a real solid lead. A pawn shop owner called and said that they believed that the Andrew Cunanan that was wanted for multiple murders had come into their store just 4 days before Versace's murder. Cunanan had stolen a gold coin from Lee Miglin and did pawn that coin at a shop in Miami Beach. This idiot used his own driver's license and filled out a form using his actual name and even put his thumbprint on it. That was a slip up that investigators could not believe that Cunanan had made, because what serial killer on the run from the FBI uses their real name and driver's license to pawn an item stolen from a murder victim? Again, I can't tell if he's arrogant or stupid, but people say he had a high IQ, so I guess we're going with arrogant. The address on the form was just a few blocks away from the pawn shop at the Normandy Hotel. Investigators got a search warrant for the hotel room, and they set up a perimeter around the hotel, complete with a SWAT team. They were not taking any chances. This is a multiple violent murderer. They went to room 322. They kicked in the door, and unfortunately, Andrew Cunanan was not there. But all of his belongings were. The hotel employees said that they actually had not seen Cunanan in the hotel since a few days before Versace's murder. As investigators narrowed in on Cunanan, tips started coming in from all over the world. People claimed to have seen him in Thailand, DC, New York, and so on and so on. And Andrew Cunanan seemed to be nowhere and everywhere at the same time, taking on a kind of Baba Yaga persona. He's not Baba Yaga. He is not the boogeyman. He could never be John Wick. John Wick is a nice man who kills people. But he did it because they killed his dog. Okay? Don't get it twisted. So after days with no luck, the FBI and Miami began to disagree on where they believed Cunanan was. The FBI was convinced that he had managed to escape somehow, but Miami police were sure that they had sealed off the island before he could have gotten away. But with the widespread sightings on Cunanan, you know, just being all over the world, the FBI decided to leave Miami. And that meant that it was up to Miami police to find the killer themselves. They worked in 20-hour shifts to find Cunanan because, you know, He's a spree killer, and when he ran out of money or when he wanted something again, he was likely to kill. 8 days after Versace's murder, police got a 911 call from a marina in Miami Beach. There were shots fired on a houseboat belonging to a German club owner who at the time was out of the country. A caretaker went to check on the boat, but once he stepped inside, he noticed signs that someone was there, like had been living there. And then he heard a shot from further inside the boat, and so he ran out and called 911. Detectives rushed over, and they believed that it was Andrew Cunanan inside the houseboat. They set up a command post across the street from the boat and had Marine Patrol in the water to make sure that no one could swim away. The entire boat was surrounded, and the entire block was cordoned off. They weren't sure what was about to happen, but they did know that whoever was inside had a gun, even if it wasn't Andrew Cunanan. They attempted to contact the person on the boat because there was a phone on board, but after 5 hours, there was no answer. The SWAT team shot 5 rounds of tear gas into the houseboat, and then 3 more after several minutes, and that is a lot of tear gas. So if someone was alive in there, they would have probably come running out. So Navarro and an FBI agent, because, you know, they're back into the picture now, entered the houseboat wearing gas masks. Upstairs, they found a body propped up by 2 pillows laying on its back with a gun laid across its chest. It was Andrew Cunanan, and he was dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. The country breathed a sigh of relief that serial killer Andrew Cunanan was dead. He seemed to kill randomly and at times for nothing more than a ride. It seemed to many that Cunanan killed Versace because he was the epitome of what Cunanan wanted to be, you know, but he would never be able to achieve because he didn't want to actually do anything. He was famous, rich, talented, and a nice person, which is something Cunanan just wasn't capable of because he was a pathological liar and a person willing to kill just to keep up an image. Did Andrew Cunanan and Gianni Versace actually know each other, though? That's one of my big questions. Doesn't matter if they did or didn't, just, you know, a question. Cunanan typically had been known to brag about his acquaintance with Versace. Whether or not that was true, really, that's anyone's guess. It could be, it could not be. But during the investigation, it was alleged that the two had in fact met. And one source claimed that they had run into each other in a San Francisco nightclub in 1990. And another said that he had seen Cunanan in a limo with Versace. Those are really vague. So did Cunanan kill Versace to become famous? And again, that's a question that I am currently asking myself out loud. I doubt that it was a random killing unless Cunanan just somehow ended up in Miami Beach and somehow spotted Versace walking down the street. Like, it seemed that killing an incredibly famous person may have been the motive here, because now, of course, Andrew Cunanan will forever be tied to the Versace name, where otherwise, like, his name would have been forgotten in a millisecond. Like, and I don't say that, you know, just because he's not rich or he wasn't rich or famous. I say that because he was just a shitty person. 1 week after his death, thousands of mourners came to pay tribute to Gianni Versace in Milan. Antonio said that half of him died the day that Gianni did. People traveled from every corner of the world just to pay their respects, including Princess Diana, who sat in the front row just weeks before her own untimely death. Antonio believes that he and Gianni are still together and that he will see him again. And I watched part of a documentary where Antonio said that, and I cried a little bit when he did, because it was incredibly, incredibly sad. And, you know, his life was taken way too soon. Okay, that's it. I know. Depressing. There will be a little bit of a rant here, because what a truly unsatisfying ending. Like, I wanted Andrew Cunanan to go to jail and to rot there, because that would have been the worst punishment for him. Like, really, truly. But instead, he decided not to face any consequences. Also, I realize that he murdered a celebrity, but don't forget that he also murdered 4 other people that we know of that do not get even like a fraction of the coverage of Versace's murder. A life is a life. I tried to find out as much information as I could about the other victims, because I didn't even know before researching this case that Andrew Cunanan was a serial or spree killer. I had no clue. I just knew him as the man who killed Gianni Versace. But each one of these murders was completely senseless and totally, totally avoidable. I say that because Cunanan actually had to travel to commit each of these murders. It's not like these were people who like lived around him and that he had been in long-term conflict with. Some of these people were complete strangers. Like he killed a former lover and they weren't even on bad terms. And I believe that he planned to kill him because he actually traveled to Minneapolis to do it. And I think that he killed Jeffrey Trail because he thought that he and David Madsen were having some sort of affair. But even if they were, you know, you two weren't together. It's none of your business. And it certainly is not worth killing for. And the way Cunanan drove across the country, only stopping when he needed to ditch a car or get some money, it seems like the murders of Lee Miglin and William Reese were just completely random. I think that he saw like a big fancy house in Chicago in the case of Lee, and he knew that there would be something valuable inside. So he broke in, probably was surprised by Lee, killed him, and then ate a fucking sandwich afterward and took off in his car. Like, I wish to God that whoever leaked the fact that the cell phone box was tracking the stolen Lexus had just not done that, because William Reese and Gianni Versace probably would not have been murdered. They would have probably tracked and caught Andrew Cunanan right then and there before he committed two more murders. But when the car was being tracked, he pulled over to a cemetery, probably because he saw a truck out front. It was probably in the middle of nowhere, and he executed an unsuspecting caretaker in the basement. Like, it is beyond callous, and it's beyond anything that I can comprehend, you know, to just kill because you need some trivial thing like a car or some money. Like, that's how little he valued human life. It was worth to him what he could get out of it. I wonder, really, if his plan all along was to work his way across the country until he got to Miami. Like, I'm not sure if he was, you know, if it was killing Versace that brought him to the city, if that was the draw, or if he got there and just saw him walking around, or, you know, figured out where he lived and just decided to do it right then and there. Of course, Cunanan claimed that he met Versace, but he was also a pathological liar, so I doubt that there's any truth to that at all. You heard some alleged witnesses came out and claimed that they saw Cunanan with Versace, but again, we all know how unreliable eyewitness testimony can be. But how disgusting to think that Cunanan, who was given every advantage in the world, sent to private school when his siblings were not. He was treated like a little prince. He didn't live up to his potential and maybe thought that the only way that he would be famous was to kill a celebrity. And again, I can't comprehend this mindset, because if I knew how a homicidal maniac thinks, then I would probably be a homicidal maniac, in the immortal words of Deputy Dewey. But I think the main takeaway here is that, you know, people who were loved by so many are gone because of the senseless actions of an asshole who would rather lie, cheat, steal, and kill rather than just admit that he's a loser and that his life isn't what he pretends it is. Well, thank you for sticking with me on that one. If you like what you hear, you can hear more on Mondays and Fridays on all podcast platforms. On social media, you can find me on Facebook at Autumn's Oddities, on Instagram at Autumn's Oddcast, on Twitter at Autumn's Oddpod, and on Patreon at Autumn's Oddities. And on Patreon, if you are a Patreon member, you have a 15% off code for the True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival in Austin, August 25th through the 27th. I will be appearing there. If you would like that discount, head on over to Patreon, join at any level. You get ad-free episodes, no ads whatsoever. I know ads are annoying, but, you know, I got to make a little bit of money. Come on. But there's ad-free episodes on Patreon. There's a discount code, and there's also episodes that only Patreon members get. There's a nice little cachet of those there. So if you binged every episode and you're like, oh, I got nothing to listen to, head over to Patreon. You'll get some extra episodes and a sweet code for a discount, because I would love to see, you know, some of my listeners. I don't know who listens. I have no idea. I know who some of you are because, you know, you're on Patreon or you're on Instagram, but I would love to meet you, truly. You know, I appreciate you listening. Thank you. And remember, if it's creepy and weird, you'll find it here.